tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So, I'd like to talk about non-grasping. It's a very important, or non-attachment. It's an important idea, often misunderstood. So if I ask you to listen to sound, and you listen to sound and you just let the sound flow through, that would be a simple idea of non-grasping. I mean, there might be deeper meanings, but that's a simple idea of non-grasping. And then if you heard the guy hammering, and the hammering became annoying because you wanted more silence, maybe you're used to really silent space, and then you didn't notice the annoyance, and you became irritated, and then you started to think, like, why doesn't this guy shut up? It's Saturday, I came here to meditate. That would be grasping, right? And that's attachment. And then you might think, I shouldn't be angry. You know, I have too much anger, I have an anger problem. And that would be grasping too. So in any moment where one can awaken to just the way things are, as objects of consciousness, rather than a personal problem or personal situation, that is the sort of just basic idea of non-grasping, non-attachment. And so the teaching tells us that the Buddha taught for suffering and the end of suffering. That was his purpose. It wasn't to answer everything. And the problem is that in our morning chanting, we do the five focuses of the grasping mind, our dukkha, and we list the khandhas, as you know, in the chanting. And so that, I think it's quite important to understand how the teachings laid out, what the Buddha is trying to point to, why he's trying to point to that, and then the methodology he encourages us to adopt in order to realize what he realized. So the five focus of grasping mind is the idea that when you don't notice the flow of consciousness, sights, sounds, tastes, bodily feelings, mental images, and you get caught up with them, then that very being caught up with them and not understanding is a kind of ignorance and causes suffering. So the mind which can both engage in the world, we have to engage in the world. So let's say if this guy's builder is there and we hear a big crash, maybe the scaffolding fell down, and then he's moaning, and we all just sit here. Non-attachment. It's not true. That's non-activity from a position, an idea that I shouldn't move or something silly like that. So non-attachment or non-grasping is neither active nor passive in a social sense. It's not saying that you do or do not do something. You have to still function in the world. And those functional parts of our life what we call conventional truth. And I often speak of that. And that's where morality and generosity and social responsibility come in. So non-grasping is talking more about flow of consciousness. And people sometimes get that mixed up. They think that because I'm worrying about my children, I'm attached. Well, I think a mother should worry about her kids and help them out and so on. But obsessive worry, obviously, the mind is just obsessed with worry, would be attachment. So you have the social reality that we live in, and then you have the flow of consciousness that we experience inwardly. And this flow of consciousness is always interactive, that things impact me, I hear when people say things to me, something triggers a memory. So it's action response. So really, it's not so separate from the outside world. It's really one kind of drama going on. You might think this is internal, that's external, but you can see that the hearing of the sound, which seems about there, is in awareness. The perception is I'm here, and the sound is there. It's one perception, it's not wrong, that's a conventional perception. But there's another perception that we're encouraged to take on board, and that's a bit more subtle, and a bit more, you don't notice it. And that's the perception that all of this is happening in awareness. That the sound, the hearing of the sound, is in awareness. Now that's not a philosophical statement. This is where people often get confused. They hear something language like that, they think, well, philosophically, well, there's no self, there's no one listening. But there is someone listening. There's still a sense of a person and a sense of a sound. But that's happening in awareness. So that's a different kind of perception which we try to pick up. And perceptions are important because they interpret how we... There are interpretations of life. That's how we build up our worldview and the way we function with each other. So if I perceive someone as being... You know, if I make a misperception, someone in the monastery is moving around rather lackadaisically, and I think, lazy person, and that's a perception, I'm interpreting that. And then maybe I found out, oh, the person has the flu and has a migraine headache. Ah, the perception changes to one of, ah, that's why they're moving slowly. So perception is something that's always operating, and sometimes it's accurate, but as you and I know, sometimes it's not so accurate. It's comes from places which are not wise, which are somewhat deluded. So the analogy I was using in Toronto this past weekend is a very simple one. Of if you have a sheet of paper, and then you have some kind of text written on a sheet of paper, and you're following the text and you're reading it. It might be a novel, and it's a very interesting novel, and you're fascinated by it all. What you don't tend to notice is the paper. You tend to notice the print. And you tend to be absorbed in the print. Go from one page to another, one page to another, and you get another book. You get one page to another, one page to another, get another book. And paper is really analogous. When you notice the paper, it's kind of analogous to noticing that there is awareness, and awareness is spacious. That there is presence, that there is consciousness, and that presence is the space within which things arise and cease. So the fascination with the print is necessary. You know, what was the image I was using in Toronto? Yeah, if you're boiling some milk, right, and you don't pay attention to you're heating up a saucepan of milk and you don't pay attention to that, boils over and you have a mess. So you have to pay attention to the print. And that's what we call conventional truth. But if the print was the only thing you had, you'd be jumping from one novel to another. Endless rebirth. One emotion to another. One situation to another, right? One fascinating thing to one boring thing to one fascinating thing to one boring thing. So the mind would be endlessly preoccupied with objects. And those are the five khandhas. Sights and sounds and smells and tastes and bodily feelings and mental images and feelings of love and hate and social situations and all the rest of it. So to notice the page is like when I suggest to you just listen to sound, feel the body, toggle between those two and see that, perceive the awareness of space. You see, that's always there. We don't notice that. Because we're so fascinated by objects. And why are we fascinated by objects? Because pleasure and pain. You know, that we as human beings have to have pleasure and pain just to operate biologically. But also we prefer pleasure, and that's a kind of biological necessity. We don't like pain. And so we overestimate the value of pleasure and pain. We don't see its limitation, and we don't see its limitation, then we're always pursuing pleasure and running away from pain. And that's, you know, that's easy to see. Maybe like my knee hurts, so I move away from it. Conventional truth, fine, nothing wrong with it. But there's a lot of unpleasant and painful things that we experience inwardly that we run away from. And one of the ways we run away from it, we get angry at it. Crawford and I were talking about when you, it's the same, your example was the same as what I do. You kind of, let's say you bump your head up, maybe you're cleaning under a machine and you bump your head in the machine and you want to strangle the machine. The machine doesn't care, you stupid machine, because you don't want that. I don't want that pain. Because I don't want that pain, I you know, exhibit some kind of anger. I think we all have that. So unfortunately, for whatever reason, the flow of consciousness that we experience is attractive and neutral and unattractive. And we call that Vedana. Vedana is a Pali word. So the movement of emotions or bodily feelings or sounds and tastes moves from being attractive, neutral, unattractive. There's a whole range of things. And so the mind, which sees only print, sees only the possibility of happiness in conditioned things, in sense experiences, in emotions, in social situations, in intellectual pursuits, in craft pursuits, in YouTube presentations, and so on and so forth. If that's the only thing I know that brings me happiness, then what else could I do but just try to maximize pleasure and minimize pain? And we all do that to a certain extent, but the Buddha is saying there is something more. There is another way to look at this, and that's the way of noticing the page. Now, noticing the page, and I think all of us, you know, most of us have had some, you know, experience like that where you might be on a lake, or you're just very quiet with yourself, and you're just more with a space of awareness rather than the particular object that's presenting itself. And then maybe there's some loud music next door, and you think, oh, I wish they'd shut up so I could go back to the space. But the space never left. It's always there. It's always available. And we sometimes mistake pleasure. Like when the mind has that kind of deep peace, and it's not caught up with the khandhas, it is pleasurable, and we do like it, but we mistake that peaceful feeling, we think it's an object. So when something unpleasant comes into consciousness, we reject that. But it's the very attachment to the pleasant and the unpleasant which leads to the attachment to desire. And so the desire becomes this kind of restless energy that is pursuing pleasure and trying to get rid of pain in all manner of ways. So I think to take Buddhism deeply, you have to take on board there is this, shall we say, transcendent or deeply peaceful possibility, which isn't just becoming some kind of a happy, good person. The project of becoming a better person is fine, but that the project of being a better person is the method in Buddhism rather than the goal. So you take something like patience. You know, it's something we're taught about as kids, is be patient. Now if you take patience as the goal, then of course you feel bad for being impatient. But if you see that patience is the logical way of practicing when you feel impatient, and it's the logical way of non-attachment, non-grasping, you look at patience from wisdom rather than from idealism. You look at patience, that is the strategy for one of the strategies for non-grasping. That's the method. Then you begin to see, if I'm more patient with this whatever that I get impatient with, if I actually train my mind, then that is non-grasping. And why do I do that? Not just to become a better person, not just for that reason, although that would be a side benefit for myself and others, but rather because I'm interested in the page. And that to me seems a much, much more, shall we call it a spiritual endeavor, different endeavor than just always trying to be a perfect person. Because that, of course, is impossible. You always end up being impatience will arise and so on. But if you see, yeah, that is part of the method. Or something like, say, forgiveness. Take forgiveness. Forgiveness, if I think that the goal is to always be forgiving, then I don't feel forgiving, for some reason I feel resentful, rather than seeing resentment as a natural condition that comes and goes, not grasping it, I grasp resentment with the idea that I should be forgiving. And I'm caught up in the condensing, and there's me, there's this terrible resentment I have, and I should forgive, and the whole thing's a mess. But if I see resentment lingering in the mind, I'm resentful. Forgiveness is a method for letting go of resentment. Then I see the logic of that, and I don't want my mind enmeshed in resentment. Not just because it's an unpleasant state of mind to hang about in, but also because I'm interested in the page. Right? There's always this, I think, higher dimension going on that people sometimes don't quite realize. Compassion, generosity, meditative stillness, awareness, wisdom, all these things, you can see they all make sense just functionally. Much more fun to be generous and be to mean-spirited. It's a much happier state of mind. But sometimes we do feel mean-spirited, and that's actually okay. So if I took the ideal that I should be generous and share all my cookies with all of you all the time, and then I didn't feel like it, and I took two and you only got one, or something like that, and I'd feel guilty about it, then that's still attachment. That's still being caught up in the drama, in the print, and just saying, oh, just mean-spirited, and it's just something that comes and it goes. But if I was systematically, consistently, obsessively mean-spirited, and someone helped me along and say, you know what, how you could get out of that attachment would be by practicing generosity, I'd say, oh, that's the way, that's the method, not just to become a generous person, but to notice the page. Huh? So take that, you know, you can take that example throughout the wholesome qualities that we develop and the unwholesome qualities that we get caught up into. It's a very simple model. So let's say something simple like, let's say I get diagnosed, they look at my, some doctor looks at my blood cells and they say, oh, I've got leukemia, right? And so functionally, I have to deal with leukemia, but inwardly I might be worried, will I ever get my shower in the new building? What's going to happen to me? And, oh, I should have written my will, and I start thinking all kinds of things like that, and worried, and then non-grasping would be still going to the doctor, but non-grasping would be, so, yeah, fear feels this way, the way I always talk, right? Fear feels this way. And then maybe bringing up something, it's all right, just trust. Trust in your good karma, or whatever. And that's a pretty simple one, really. I mean, it might be very intense, it's a very simple one. The more difficult ones are the things that are ingrained in us, the way we react to life, in ways which we think are, they're so close to us, they seem like ultimate truths. So someone who is very judgmental, say, you know, so there's action, response, action, response, action, response. And so the judgmental person is just always judging. They're always judging. Oh, it's too big, too small, they're too loud, they're too quiet, it's too hot, it's too cold, too much talk, not enough talk, da 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 da, the mind going all the time. And that might be so close to one that it's just become a reality, the judging mind. Judgment is fine. Functionally, you need judgment. But if it was just always coming from me and them, me and them, me and them, me and them, and it was so close that you wouldn't even know it's happening, now that is more difficult. And that's what we really work with. Because I think the extremes, we see, wow, I'm really upset or I'm really worried. But just this kind of insidious self-view that comes up, self-disparagement or judgment of others or hankering for something or just always wishing for more. Like one of the things I notice in my mind now, I just feel guilty that I don't exercise enough. It just constantly comes up. I wake up, didn't exercise enough. Guilty. didn't exercise enough guilty. So I mean, just exercise or shut up, Erdama, right? Just do it. But there's this kind of on lingering kind of nagging voice and stretch you lazy thing. And that's just, that's like, who, you know, who's, that's not helping me or anyone else. It doesn't help me to stretch. And those things can just be so close to you, you don't even notice them. You don't even notice them. Self-criticisms or judgment and so on. So what we're monitoring then, we're really trying to monitor thought, to really awaken to thought and to awaken to the what we call the mood of the mind, or cittanupassana, which is the third foundation of mindfulness. What's the mood of the mind? And that kind of inward monitoring, as we all know, is very necessary. Now that's not, it's not analyzing or judging or criticizing, it's just seeing what's the background tone going on. And even, you know, if the background tone is worry, that's not wrong, but there's something in me which says, no, this is happening in awareness. This, I'm more interested in the page than in the drama or the description or whatever it is. And getting out of those attachments to hard-held, you know, we hold fast to these self-views or emotional ways of operating, that's very, very hard. It's much more subtle. To others it might be very, very obvious, but to us it's, maybe it's been going on so continuously and so strongly that we just think, well, this is ultimate truth. But it's still thought. It's still thought. So any thought is still a thought. Any self-judgment, any judgment of others, just a judgment, it's just that. And just to see that that is just a judgment, functionally use it when necessary, but also say, oh, no, I'm more interested in the page, is the non-grasping of judgment. And so one could see how if I am very, very judgmental and I put in alternative kinds of mind states like metta, may all beings be free from judgment, or may all beings be free from suffering, and I actually encourage that in my mind, then I've got another kind of energy which comes up to help me when I'm unkind or when I'm fiercely judgmental of myself. But that's not the goal. You know, I realized this once. I was listening to His Holiness the Dalai Lama in, when was it, I forget, in New Zealand probably, and he said, compassion is the method. I said, oh, yeah, of course. And until then, I had inadvertently taken the position that compassion was the goal. Because, yeah, I should be compassionate, I should be like him. And I was failing terribly. But then he said, compassion is the method. That really made me ponder, what is he pointing to there? So the barami are not the goal, they're the method. Right? And what is the goal? It's non-grasping. If you take the goal in time that, okay, I'm going to just like chalk up my barami now, you know, get all these really good little pieces in place, and then at some future time, I'll just let go. That's not true either. It's always in the moment, in the moment, in the moment. And so the practice is very, like in the context of what's happening in your mind right now. That's why I think systematic methods or techniques for me have never really worked, because I'm not a fixed thing that you can always apply techniques to. There's a dynamism that goes on here according to causes and conditions and time and place and age and all that that I have to attend to and then apply the methodologies which would be appropriate there. You see what I mean? So compassion is the method. The barami is the method. But what is the goal? The goal is the page. And what is that? It's that this is happening in awareness. And so how can you come to that? Well, then the kind of perceptual structures that we're sort of encouraged to develop, if you think about how we're encouraged to think and to perceive, and perception is very important, how I'm interpreting things, is to first of all take responsibility for our social life, and that's conventional truth. So again, sila, and dana, and personal responsibility, and all the rest of it. So that's who I am in the world, who I am in the monastery. But then within that, there's the inner, there's the flow of conscious experience, and then the the perception that we're encouraged to cultivate is one, this is happening in awareness rather than the sense of I, like let's say the body. I say the body is bodily sensations, even the body as an abstract is fine. But you know, what's actually happening in the moment? And the practice is always in the moment. It's not 2 moments later, it's always in the moment. It's like the kind of Eckhart Tolle's the power of now. I mean, that's what's pointing to. So what's happening right now is bodily feelings are changing in awareness. And then what that does, that challenges the whole sense of I am someone in the body. This is my body. I am this body. And you get that recitation all the time. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. I am not that. So then, what is that perception, I'm not that? How do you do that? Well, you notice this is in awareness. The body's in awareness. That self-disparagement is in awareness. That disgust for someone is in awareness. That infatuation for someone is in awareness. Self-view is, that person is so disgusting, I hate them. Or that person is so lovely, I really love them. And that's pretty obvious, we've been practicing enough. But then the disgusting, I shouldn't be disgusted, that's attachment to what I think should be. Whereas disgust is in awareness, infatuation is in awareness. Huh? You're going to see that's what we mean by not self. Not that it's not happening, but the very perception of someone receiving this or doing something is in awareness. Awareness is always bigger. So that's one kind of perception you can play with, which is really around anatta, or not self. The other one is impermanence. That's the perception that we're asked to cultivate is the perception of lompo cha, uncertainty. It's amanye, uncertain, not sure. This is changing. Now when you, let's say I feel really doubtful about something and my mind just churning away with doubt, if I can step back and see, to perceive doubt as a changing energy, energetic condition, that's non-grasping. That's hard to do because I'm so embedded in thought, so embedded in trying to figure this out and solve my doubts. Trying to see doubt is something that arises, endures for a while, and ceases. And this is, and so that the perception of change brings you to the same space, same kind of attitude or posture, whatever you want, as this is in awareness. It's both are non-grasping. Both are non-grasping. Now if you take the perception of change, well, what does it mean? Am I noticing change or not? Then you think I should have some kind of anicca experience. This is quite common. You know, people read about that and think, well, I have to have this anicca experience. And I just observe, and I see anicca, and then it all changes. And I'm in a stream of Dhamma. And so you start looking for something called an inside experience, and you don't see that there's a sense of self searching in time for some kind of experience, and that's a delusion. It's future, time, becoming self. But in the moment you see, oh, this, you perceive the feeling of wanting something from anicca, from change, perception of change, that's non-grasping. And do that with sound. You notice, you do like perceive that as sound, and the perceive as change. And it's very, you know, it's very subtle. It's not like, oh, it's not like an experience you get. It's more like you are that which knows change. It's different. Be that which knows change. You listen, perceive it as change. I do that a lot. I take very simple things, you know, like bodily feelings. Just take my hands during a sitting and just I'll do warmth today. And just perceive it as change. So train your mind to perceive the khandhas, the changing inner and the changing experiences you have through the perception of change rather than the perception of self. And if you take the ordinary and the mundane and you encourage yourself to train in that way, then in the extraordinary, the difficult, the complicated, there's more tendency, more chance that you will engage in that difficulty from the perception of change. If you've not done that training, then usually self-view just takes over and you're kidnapped. Right? So that if, like in our Vinaya training, we read our Vinaya, and the idea of the Vinaya training is take care of the little rules, the big rules will take care of themselves. Or maybe that's with driving too. You know, take care of the kind of moment by moment caution, and then you'll be ready for any difficult event. So the perception of change, and that's not a, you know, that's different than having a intellectual agreement, or you agree, yes, things change. Yeah, of course. You know, it doesn't take a Buddha to figure that out. You know, the weeds grow. But what the actual employment of a perception for non-grasping is a dynamic use of that teaching, rather than a static position. That Buddhists believe in change. They believe in not self. Thank you very much. Right? That would never work. And that's probably the difficulty, is that we can understand a bunch of ideas and then think that's it, but then we forget to employ them. So the task of the contemplative is constantly enlivening the mind with these correct perceptions happening in awareness, or the perception of change. The third perception is dukkha, right? So you have anatta, and the way I like to do that is this is happening in awareness rather than me experiencing this as a separate person. And then anicca, perception of change, or dukkha is the perception of unsatisfactoriness. And for me, it's that basic idea that it's not the print, it's the page. It's not the print, it's the page. It's that really basic, fundamental, all print is the same. It's unsatisfactory. Which doesn't mean that I don't enjoy, you know, beautiful things and aesthetic things and so on. I do, you know, it's just natural. But that's not the page. You know, aesthetics isn't the page. My flavor of ice cream isn't the page. My type of literature isn't the page. So I prefer, like, I like to read history. I don't like to read philosophy. I don't even like to read Buddhism anymore. A little bit. But, you know, my preferences of books is not, you know, it's just a preference. So if I can't get my preferences, fine. It's just this feeling of being not getting your preferences. So the perception of dukkha, that everything that arises ceases, is not self, and is unsatisfactory, is that statement is always in relationship to Nibbana or the transcendent. It's not an absolute statement that all beauty is bad, right? It's just in relation. So you might have beautiful writing, beautiful literature, really riveting literature, beautiful ideas, but it's not the page. You know, you can really enjoy the literature. It's like a beautiful, you know, read some really beautiful Rumi poetry or, you know, something really fantastic. Does it take you to the page, or do you go by the book? and buy all the guy's books, right? Or something like that. Does it take you to the page? Art is that way. Does art take you to the object, or does it take you back to the silence? When you look at art and the beauty of the art stops your mind, and you come to stillness, and you realize that stillness, then that would be spiritual art, whatever art you want. If you looked at the art and then you critiqued it, and you know, I don't like that, I'll buy that one, that's idolatry, where you idolize the art piece as in itself, that's what's important. But in spiritual art, then, the object isn't important. The object points. So the print indicates that there's always a page. And so that's the idea of spiritual art. Iconography, a beautiful Buddha, is the same as an ugly Buddha. Beauty and ugly are the ways we perceive things, but what it points to is the awakened mind, points to the page. And so when we look at a Buddha Rupa and we find aesthetically it's unpleasing, if we awaken to that, oh, that's the aesthetic feeling of unpleasant, and we stay with that, we come back, this is happening in awareness, then that Buddha Rupa points to enlightenment. If, however, we look at that Buddha Rupa every day and we look at it, oh, I don't like the ears, Don't like the nose, bad posture, that's worldly. So we lose the whole point of having a Buddha image. You might have a flower there. Huh? So the method, huh? Compassion is the method. Patience is the method. And non-grasping is always here and now. It's always, it's very simple. So don't, please don't take non-grasping as non-experience. Some people think non-grasping means you never feel hatred or jealousy. That's not the idea. Hatred and jealousy are simply in awareness. So yeah, we have conditioned phenomena that come to us unbidden, unasked for, and certainly unwelcome. But there they are. You know, they arise in consciousness, and they're no one's fault. They're just the karmic momentum of consciousness, the way it's been conditioned. And that's the kind of real generosity and great compassion of the Buddhist teaching, is it all belongs, as Ajahn Sumedho says, good, bad, and the ugly. So it's the non-grasping of changing things rather than the quality of changing things. Quality of changing things is as it is. So non-grasping does not mean it would be like a sustained positive state of mind for 50 years. You know, if you took it to absurdity, it's not possible. It's not true. So positive, it's nicer to hang out with positive, so you can see if you don't rob banks, and you're not a heroin addict, and you don't abuse your neighbors, and you don't kill beings, and you don't get drunk and stoned all the time, you're probably going to have a better chance of staying in awareness. Whereas do the other, it'll be more difficult. So morality is a method, it's not an end in itself. Look how people who attach to morality, they get self-righteous, I keep the 8 precepts, you only keep the 5 precepts. Something like that. Or you keep the 5th precept, you don't drink, and someone's drinking a bit of wine, and you degenerate for a bit of wine. But that's attachment to morality. Morality is the method. So at all, you begin to see that the teachings are very practical, not idealistic. And that the non-grasping, that's the whole point of it, non-attachment. So in that Buddha Comes to Sussex, maybe some of you saw that, a lovely video of Lompa Cha, and Lompa Cha sitting on the bench in front of Chitra's house, and the interviewer says, "So what's Buddhism about?" And Lompa says, "Ploy Wang." And he says, and the translator says, "What does that mean?" The translator says, "Let go." And Lompa Cha has this big, great Cheshire cat smile, right? And Wang, Wang, beautiful, beautiful image. Ploy Wang. And then the guy starts asking, "What do you mean by letting go?" And then, Wang, and Lompa Cha says, "Ploy Wang." So it's very, very straightforward and simple, but it's our minds that are complicated. Attachment to desire is complicated. Our habitual conditioned things from who knows where are very powerful. So we get overwhelmed, but the beauty of it, you can always come back, you can always awaken to sound, it all belongs. This is a really deep, 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 this is where metta is not just me liking you. This is, I think the transcendent meaning of metta is this sense that in awareness, when awareness is compassionate, that's the goal, that's non-grasping. So non-grasping is compassionate awareness. It's very beautiful, beautiful kind of idea. But that, the way the word compassion implies a kind of duality, right? So it's not the love of like transcendent love is not the opposite of hate. It's not like the opposite of liking. It's the sense of all-inclusive. It all belongs. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.